is Friday, August the 26th. This is VOA's International Edition. Very good to have you with us today. Coming up, latest on the deadly attack at American University in Kabul and why it was a target.
It's a symbol of Afghanistan's cooperation with its international allies, namely the United States. It's a sign of progress in Afghanistan, of hope in the future.
Also ahead, tense incidents between the U.S. and Iran on the high seas. Immigrants helping immigrants, preventing and treating HIV/AIDS, plus a preview of a poignant new film. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. 10 hours after it started late Wednesday, the attack on Kabul, in Kabul, on American University of Afghanistan was over and numerous people were dead. At a U.S. military briefing, Brigadier General Charles Cleveland, who is Deputy Chief of Staff for Communications for U.S. support in Kabul, was asked about the presence of U.S. advisors at the time of the attack.
You ask about the advisors. Again, they were not physically at the university when the attack occurred, but as their response occurred, they did accompany, again, their partners that they work with habitually. And again, I would stress it was not a U.S. effort or even U.S.-led. We had a very small presence. It was a larger NATO effort of people who work with them. And then finally, on responsibility, we have not seen at least a public claim of responsibility for this yet. We would expect this, but at this point, we don't have a complete sense of who conducted it, be it the Taliban, be it the Haqqani Network, or be it somebody else.
Reporter Suni Rasmussen in Kabul speaks with International Edition Sarah Williams about that attack and the origin of the attackers, plus more.
Normally, we get one militant group or the other claiming responsibility within a couple of hours of an attack or maximum the day after. But the Taliban haven't claimed responsibility. They say they're investigating, whatever that means. The Islamic State, who perpetrated one attack, their first in Kabul about a month ago, have also been silent. Some speculation might be the Haqqani Network, who's a more radical arm of the Taliban movement. But all that is guesswork at the moment. We don't really know who's behind it, and I think we shouldn't jump to conclusions. But it is unusual that nobody has come forth to claim responsibility yet.
Well, in addition to the attackers, is it known who were the people that were killed?
7 of them were students, including at least one woman, and then there were 3 police officers. At least one of them died in battle against the terrorists. He was a world-renowned commander in the special forces. And then 2 university guards were also killed.
Is it known why this site was selected? Was it because of its relations with the U.S.?
No. I mean, since there's been no claim of responsibility, we don't know why the American university was the target of the attack. But, I mean, people have been speculating. It's a symbol of Afghanistan's cooperation with its international allies, namely the United States. It's a sign of progress in Afghanistan, of hope in the future. It's a sign of the West's ambitions to create progress or help progress in Afghanistan. But then it's also a place where both men and women study together. It's co-education. And that does rub some people the wrong way in Afghanistan. We don't know what of those motivations could have triggered this attack, or if it's something different. But those are some of the things that people are speculating here. That would be, the obvious reasons would be one of those.
Reporter Suni Rasmussen, he's in Kabul, speaking with my colleague Sarah Williams. Now Syria, where the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, says a pause in fighting there is better than nothing, but warned it's not enough.
Unless fighting stops inside, unless those pauses first happen and then become permanent, there's millions of people that are trapped inside the country. And I hate to think what their fate is if we cannot reach them very quickly.
Russia has agreed to a 48-hour humanitarian ceasefire in the divided Syrian city of Aleppo to allow aid deliveries, but UN officials are saying security guarantees are needed from other parties who are on the ground. United Nations has pushed for a weekly 48-hour pause in fighting in Aleppo to alleviate the suffering of the some 2 million people, with major powers backing opposition sides in Syria's five-year-old civil war. And then Grandi said,
it is possible to move and at least give first aid assistance to people if weapons cease. But we need that indispensable precondition. Otherwise, there's no point in doing it. It's even impossible to access the people in need.
On August the 19th, the main umbrella group for the Syrian opposition cautiously welcomed the proposal for a weekly 48-hour truce in Aleppo to allow aid, provided this would be monitored by the United Nations. Also, some stories we're covering here on The Voice of America. The U.S. hoping to shore up support for Syria. The plan there, along with Gulf nations. World Bank president seeking a second term. Plus, Brazilian police charging a U.S. swimmer with filing a false crime report. More on those stories at voanews.com and also on the VOA mobile app. U.S. military says its Navy ships sailing in the Persian Gulf were forced to fire warning shots and flares after being harassed by Iranian vessels in increasing close encounters in the Strait of Hormuz. The incidents span multiple days this week. International Edition's Lori London speaks with Jamil Jaffer, who is a professor of law and director of the Homeland and National Security Law Program at George Mason University School of Law.
Look, this is a dangerous scenario. You've got people speeding up. This is a very narrow waterway. At its narrowest point, the Straits of Hormuz are only 21 nautical miles wide. So a very narrow choke point. You know, 20% of the world oil passes through that choke point, right? 90% of the Persian Gulf oil comes through that choke point. And so, you know, billions of barrels of oil every day. And so, you know, it's a dangerous place. And, you know, Iran threatened in the past to shut down the straits. And this is not the first time they've talked about that. They talked about that again back in May and July. And, you know, it's been going on for years. Back in 2012, they did the same thing. And if you remember, back in the 80s, Lori, you know, they mined the Gulf. And we had to escort tankers through the Gulf, if you remember.
What do you think they're trying to do here? Why are they sort of poking the bear here?
Yeah, so, you know, look, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, you know, is the sort of the core force that the Supreme Leader relies upon. Different from the sort of the Navy itself, the standard Navy. And so this is sort of his personal, you know, harassment force. The Quds force is the elite force within the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps. And, you know, so what you see going on here is sort of low-level harassment going up a little bit more than usual. In part, you know, the Iranians say, look, this is our area. We don't want you here. You know, stay out. Now, Iranian gunboats regularly patrol in the Persian Gulf. I was on the Stennis back in 2011, 2012, when it was patrolling the Gulf, and we were on board the ship, and, you know, the commander pointed out Iranian gunboats patrolling between the U.S. aircraft carrier that we were on and its escort ships. It's a very narrow area. The Iranians viewed it as their sovereign territory. Of course, international law dictates that straits are, people have to permit, you know, both, whether it's, you know, innocent passage or transit passage are sort of two terms used in international law, but they have to permit passage through those straits, and the U.S. Navy has regularly taken the view that it's our responsibility to ensure that there's freedom of navigation in key straits like these ones, where it's a global choke point, particularly for oil.
It would seem that the Revolutionary Guards are suspicious somehow of U.S. military activity near Iranian borders. Despite any agreement last year, the nuclear accord between Iran and the six world powers, including the United States, which you would think would potentially ease some tensions.
Well, you know, this is part of the challenge of the nuclear agreement, you know, Lori. It's, you know, we got into the agreement at a time when Iran was still engaged in very, you know, aggressive activities overseas. They've been funding the war in Syria, supporting the Syrians. They have had their military forces all over, you know, this region. They're in Iraq. They're running around the Revolutionary Guards, Quds forces all around Iraq and Syria. And, you know, their proxy force, Hezbollah, has been heavily involved in the Syrian conflict. And so, you know, the Iranians run a covert nuclear program. They engage in support of terrorist groups, Hezbollah and Hamas. They engage in aggressive activities against U.S. ships in the Persian Gulf, and we do a nuclear deal with them thinking, well, maybe they'll get better, right? And in fact, what we're doing is rewarding bad behavior, and the bad behavior continues, and it's not surprising. And so, you know, at some point, the United States has got to put its foot down and say enough is enough. Iran is not doing the right thing, and we have to think about other measures to take against them, whether that means doing something with the nuclear deal or returning the imposition of sanctions. And that doesn't even mention, by the way, Lori, Iran's terrible human rights record against its own people. And so, you know, it's deep things to be worried about here in this region.
And really, it remains to be seen whether the actions, from what I'm understanding, were carried out by maybe rogue Revolutionary Guard commanders or actually sanctioned by senior officials in Tehran.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is a pretty much a pattern of activity. I doubt this rogue activity. The Iranians have long, you know, taken the view that the Straits of Hormuz are theirs. They can close them at will, and they will harass naval ships, U.S. naval ships in particular, at will when they choose to do so. This is a pattern of activity. It started in December with the firing of rockets near the Truman, continued in May and July. You know, they had the USS New Orleans in July where they ran armed gunboats right next to it. And this is just the latest incident. And again, you know, no matter what the U.S. does to sort of try and appease the Iranians, they don't seem to stop their bad behavior, and it almost benefits them to keep doing these things. They get better deals with the nuclear deal or the like, and it's troubling, and it's something we need to keep an eye on and really consider doing something about in the near future.
That's Jamil Jaffer. He's a professor of law, also director of the Homeland and National Security Law Program at George Mason University School of Law. He was speaking with International Edition's Lori London. This is VOA.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else. Right here on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. As the political debate rages over U.S. immigration policy, those who are already here in the United States face numerous challenges trying to fit into the new culture. VOA discovered the new immigrants are helping each other, and it's become really very effective. We get more now from VOA's Carol Pearson.
Nigerian immigrant Mariam Oyetunji is a single mother of twins. Now 13 months old, Isabel and Isaac are clearly the center of a household filled with love.
I'm so glad I had them. They're very healthy. They're very strong. They're my everything.
But Mariam was not always this relaxed about motherhood. Her unexpected pregnancy, a less than enthusiastic partner, and a very traditional African family left her in need of support.
Our culture is to live with your parents until you get married. So my situation with getting pregnant and not married, it was looked down upon. I needed to find something, somewhere, somebody who can help me. Because I personally did not know how to help myself.
She found help at Mary Center, a nonprofit health organization serving people in the greater Washington, D.C. area, including people from more than 100 countries. Over 60% immigrants, the staff is a reflection of the people they serve. Janani Ramachandran grew up in India, a background she says helps her help others navigate a sometimes unfriendly system.
There are biases in the healthcare system, in the mental health system of Western medicine, not respecting different cultural approaches. And I see that in the way I'm from India, I see that in the way Indians sometimes can perceive this, as well as other cultures in my work here, how African immigrants, Latino immigrants can perceive some cultural insensitivity.
Mary Center began in 1988 as a basement prenatal clinic for Latin American women who had nowhere to turn. Today, with an operating budget of over $40 million, it serves tens of thousands of people in seven locations. For producer Linda Ring, I'm Carol Pearson, VOA News.
The 2016 National Ryan White Conference on HIV Care as well as treatment has been held here in Washington this week. More than 2,000 people gathered for that. The conference is named for the young American who became the face of HIV/AIDS. Ryan White died in 1990. Dr. Laura Cheever is a physician and associate administrator for the HIV/AIDS Bureau of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. She speaks with VOA's Kim Lewis about Ryan White's legacy, as well as progress and ongoing challenges in prevention and treatment of HIV/AIDS.
Ryan White was an incredibly courageous Indiana teenager who was diagnosed with HIV when he was quite young, and his desire was to go to school. He was given just a few months to live, and he wanted to be able to go to school and live a normal life during that time, and was really shunned by his school and was not allowed to attend school. So he made it his legacy, really, to educate people about HIV, how it was transmitted, and as a result, when the Ryan White Care Act was passed, legislation to support HIV care and treatment for people around this country, they named it in honor of him. August 18th marks the 26th anniversary of the signing of that bill into law.
How has, first of all, the stigma of HIV/AIDS changed over time?
Stigma continues to be a major problem in HIV care and treatment. Stigma continues in this country at a very high rate, although what we've learned about the disease and what we can do in terms of care and treatment has drastically changed. When Ryan White was diagnosed, most people diagnosed at the time would live less than a year. Today, if someone is diagnosed and put on therapy and stays on their treatment, they can live a near normal lifespan. So that has changed. And we know also that if someone is on medication and taking it regularly, such that the virus is completely suppressed in their blood, they're not cured, we don't have a cure, but the virus is suppressed, their risk of transmitting HIV to someone else is almost zero. So much has changed, and yet the stigma really remains in many communities.
Is the stigma basically one of fear of catching the disease?
The stigma is obviously complicated. So part of it is fear, and part of it is feeling that someone who has the disease is dirty or has done something wrong or bad. Those are all part of it. Certainly in this country, still HIV is a disease that's much more common among gay men. Gay men of color, the CDC estimated in this country, have a 1 in 2 chance of getting HIV in their lifetime. So there's a lot of issues around homophobia tied up in that as well.
So what are some of the new advancements in HIV care and treatment?
Two things I'd like to highlight are, one, we're definitely going to be highlighting the important role of people living with HIV in planning at the local level around a care and treatment services. Our legislation requires we have people living with HIV be a part of that, and we are going to be highlighting the leadership that people living with HIV have and what they bring to our federal response. The other important thing I think we'll be discussing is the framework of what's called getting to zero or ending AIDS or ending the epidemic. It's called many different things in different cities, and this is where cities or states have really taken on the mandate to end AIDS in their jurisdictions and the increasing number of new cases to actually decrease the number of cases every year. And they're having some great success by really taking a broad public health approach, figuring out where the hot spots are in their community, directing resources there, directing resources to certain populations that are at highest risk, like young gay men of color, providing leadership, developing new partnerships, and doing things differently. And we have seen some great success in places like San Francisco and New York that have taken this on. So we'll be highlighting jurisdictions, Fulton County in Georgia, in the Atlanta area, Washington, D.C., the state of Washington, other cities as well.
Despite the efforts of putting information out there regarding preventing HIV/AIDS, it is still an epidemic in the United States. Why is that?
The reason why we continue to struggle with HIV in this country are multifold. The first thing is it really is a disease of poverty in this country. When we look at the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program, we serve over 500,000 people a year, which is over half of all the people living with HIV. A majority of those people live below the federal poverty line. So there are lots of structural barriers to having good health outcomes among people living with HIV. 73% of all the people we serve are racial and ethnic minorities, and so we really need to focus on addressing those disparities. And in fact, we've made some very good progress. When we really have good leadership at the state or local level, at the jurisdictional level, we've been able to accomplish some great things.
That is Dr. Laura Cheever. She is a physician, associate administrator for HIV/AIDS Bureau at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. She spoke with Kim Lewis, who is host of the VOA program, Africa News Tonight. It is time now to find out what's happening on social media. International Edition's G. Abby Lee here with the latest. Hi, G.
Hi, Steve. The National Park Service celebrated its 100th birthday Thursday. If you use hashtag NPS100 on Twitter, it will automatically generate an image of a female park ranger next to that hashtag. Many social media users are tweeting about it, and the White House is no exception. The White House shared a video clip featuring President Barack Obama and wrote this: POTUS has conserved more land and water than any other president in history. The 52-second clip starts with Mr. Obama using a selfie stick to say hello to the viewers. POTUS refers to the President of the United States.
Doesn't the National Park Service have its own Twitter account?
That's correct. And if you're interested, you can find them at National Park Service. That's NATL Park Service. And it encourages people to use two hashtags. The first one is hashtag NPS100, and the other is hashtag FindYourPark.
And what else out there is trending, G?
U.S. swimmer Katie Ledecky was trending nationwide, but especially in the DMV area. The five-time Olympic gold medalist appeared at the National Stadium last night to throw the ceremonial first pitch. She tweeted, "Great time at the Nationals game tonight. Thanks at bharper3407 for the hand." More than 6,000 people liked that tweet. The second handle belongs to a Nationals player, Bryce Harper. Now, to that tweet, she attached a photo of her pitching and Nationals player Bryce Harper standing next to her holding her Olympic medals. The top comment to that tweet reads like this: "Did you count the medals when you got them back?" Last but not least, Harper was also trending Thursday for unveiling a new line of baseball caps to benefit a nonprofit. Proceeds from the sale of the limited edition caps will go to the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. That's all for me today. Steve?
Yeah, many thanks, Gigi. I doubt Bryce Harper would have kept her medals. But anyway, you never know. That's our social media guru, G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can find G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, can be found on Twitter at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Vineyards in Britain are bubbling over in profit as Brits tilt bottles of Italian sparkling wine most people call champagne, a drink that in the past 5 years has found a welcome home in the palates of Englishmen. Winemaker Simon Roberts of Ridgeview Vineyard in Brighton.
When we planted, there was only one other winery that specialized in sparkling wine. Now there's over 300.
The country has a good climate and fertile ground for the wine business, and now British drinkers have moved to the less expensive and high-quality Italian bubbles, clearly outpacing French champagnes. Neil Bruce is the head of wine at Fuller's Bar Chain.
So we brought in additional Proseccos this year. We'll look at more for next year, but looking at sparkling wine as a category. As I mentioned, English sparkling wine would definitely be a part of that too.
37 new vineyards sprung up in Britain last year as sparkling wine sales corked out, an 80% increase over the past 5 years. Philip Alexio, VOA News.
This is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us. There's a new movie out there. It's directed by and starring actor John Krasinski. It's called The Hollers, and it takes a humorous and touching look at the dynamics of a family when the matriarch is diagnosed with brain cancer. International Edition's David Byrd tells us that Krasinski plays a graphic artist who is forced to move back home to encounter all the problems that he left behind.
Fans will know John Krasinski mostly for his role as Jim Halpert on NBC's The Office. But for The Hollers, Krasinski is wearing multiple hats: actor, director, and producer. Krasinski says he didn't want to make a typical family dramedy.
Everybody's seen a whole lot of family dramas, and this is not necessarily a straight drama. It's very funny, too. But for me, I think it was so important to make this movie because these movies aren't being told as much anymore. And I think in today's world, it's really important to go back to more simple, stronger storytelling and more classic storytelling about things like family.
So how you doing?
I feel great.
You know, I've been Googling brain tumors. A lot more common than you think.
Yeah?
Yeah. You know Bob Marley had one?
How'd that work out for him?
Well, he sold a lot of records. Got a little catching up to do.
Two-time Emmy winner Margot Martindale stars as John Holler's mother, Sally. It's Sally's diagnosis with brain cancer that causes John to move back to his boyhood home. Behind him in New York, he's left his pregnant girlfriend, Rebecca. He also encounters his high school rival, Jason, played by Charlie Day.
Okay, so you're married?
No. No, we're not.
I thought you said you're going to have a baby.
Well, I did say I was going to have a baby, but I'm not married.
Well, why aren't you getting married if you're going to have a kid?
It's a long story. You know, we talked about it. But why does that matter?
I don't know. I'm just saying, like, don't you think your kids are going to resent you for making it a bastard?
It's not going to be a bastard.
Technically, the kid would be a bastard. That's what a bastard is.
I haven't had any feelings for Gwen. Not for a long, long time. So...
John Krasinski says he thinks the key to the movie is its realistic portrayal of family life.
I think it's weirdly what we had on The Office. I think people didn't watch The Office every week just because it was funny. I think they watched it because there was a Dwight in their office or their boss was insane. And so I think the same holds true about this movie. At some point, my goal would be, or my hope would be, that audience members sort of lose the idea of the family on screen and start connecting their own dots and how their own relationships to their family work.
Margot Martindale says the chemistry that moviegoers will see on the screen was not just good acting. The cast actually bonded in a deep way.
It honestly happened. I don't mean me. We all together became something other than who we were. Mm-hmm. We became a family, and it happened almost immediately. Richard felt very much like somebody I'd been married to many, many years, and these boys felt very much like my sons. It was an unusual experience.
The Hollers also stars South African actor Charlto Copley as John's brother Ron. Copley says that Krasinski was able to juggle several roles seamlessly.
By the end of the film, I was pretty convinced that the guy's going to be really taking strain. But he was so impressive at sort of seamlessly going calmly from, you know, behind the monitor, just looking at what he was doing, and then slipping into the director's chair. And so, if anything, it was very inspirational for me to watch.
The Hollers stars Richard Jenkins as John's father, Dan, Anna Kendrick as John's girlfriend, Rebecca, and Mary Elizabeth Winstead as John's old high school flame, Gwen. It opens in U.S. theaters August 26th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
I mean, Dave, thank you so much. Everything he said makes you want to see the movie, but I got to tell you, Margot Martindale is enough reason to see anything. Listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America. Good to have you with us. World News straight ahead. I hope you'll stay tuned for that. Tracy Carter is our director. Our engineer is Jimmy Cook. I'm Steve Norman. All of that said, we hope you have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At least 15 Darfuri individuals were detained and 9 are still in detention without charge in Nyar Teti in central Darfur. The United States is gravely concerned about the government of Sudan's incarceration of these people and immediately expressed its concern about the reported detention to senior Sudanese officials. The United States calls on the government of Sudan to immediately release all those detained. The detentions followed a visit by U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan, Donald Booth, to Sudan's north and central Darfur states, as well as internally displaced persons camps at Sortoni and Nyar Teti in the Jebel Mara region of Darfur in late July. Many others who were not detained were nonetheless questioned by security officials about the nature of their contact with the Special Envoy. These actions are particularly unfortunate as they undercut the government of Sudan's initially granting permission for the special envoy's fact-finding visit and allowing him to travel to areas and speak with individuals of his choosing. Such first-hand knowledge is important to shaping future U.S. engagement with the government of Sudan and opposition groups and leaders regarding Darfur. As Sudan seeks to pursue an inclusive national political dialogue, the Sudanese people need to be free to voice their opinions. The United States urges the government of Sudan to respect its citizens' rights to freedoms of expression, peaceful assembly and association, including by the press. These are vital elements for an environment conducive to a national dialogue.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage, at www.voanews.com/editorials.